Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The many changes on the Valley Island are making many residents wonder what's up with Maui. Those changes, proposals, and their implications for the future are on our agenda this week. Today we'll talk with County Councilmember Mike White about the ongoing movement to replace the mayor with a manager. And we'll get a look at who's on Maui now with Research and Analysis Director at the Maui Economic Development Board, John Harrison.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Streetlight Cadence continues its evolution from street performance to life as a full-time touring band. Jesse Shiroma is with us in our studio. And Maui harpist Ginny Morgan turns to theater with her play Vivaldi for Breakfast at Maui On Stage.
It's Monday, June 6th. That's The Conversation coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome to a Monday on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Beth Ann. Looks as if Maui is looking at some really fundamental changes.
It is. And for anybody who lives there, as you know, the Valley Island has been undergoing a lot of change. There's that new build-out around the airport, the closure of HCNS, and a question of what will happen to its workers and the land. Also, whether condos are coming to the McKenna Resort, scheduled to close in July. And then there's the transition of Maui hospitals from the state to Kaiser. Meanwhile, Maui's population continues to grow, and the many changes on Maui are on our agenda this week, starting with an effort to get the question on the November ballot of whether Maui should have a manager instead of a mayor. Before the weekend, it was again considered by the Maui County Council, and Council Chair Mike White joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Thanks for making time for us. So just to catch everybody up a little bit, it's not exactly a total replacement of the mayor by a manager, but the mayor would be de-emphasized, although still elected, and the county council would be the ones responsible for hiring and perhaps firing a manager, correct?
That is correct. You've got it right on. We're not getting rid of the mayor, but the responsibilities would be changed and a bit reduced. And the focus would be, the focus of managing the county would fall to the, we're calling him the managing director, which is the current term for the manager's assistant. And you're right, it would be selected by the council with assistance from a search firm and probably a citizens committee.
Part of the reason behind this, and this conversation stems back to 2010, is that this would be an effort to be able to get politics out of it. But is that really possible?
Well, you're never going to get all the politics out of anything having to do with government. But for me, the degree to which you can significantly reduce the politics out of not just the selection of the manager and the operation of the county, but also get it out of the selection of the directors and deputies that run the various departments.
So, I mean, this has a spin-out factor to it. It's not just simply the one person who would be selected.
That's correct. And, you know, we have every year, or every 4 years, a turnover of directors with each new administration. And so you have people who come into positions with very little understanding of exactly what their job is, and there's a pretty steep learning curve in many of these divisions throughout the county.
The opposition to this idea has been saying for a while now that if you have the council hiring and firing a manager, then you're really thwarting democracy. How do you answer them?
Well, the nine of us are also elected by the people. And we're elected by the people every 2 years, so the community has a much more frequent shot at us than they do at the mayor. And so I think it's about the same. I don't think we're reducing democracy by any means. And there is actually a significantly larger number of county managed counties than there are those managed by a mayor.
You're talking about throughout the United States?
Yes. And actually, in counties our size, I believe there's 36 managed by mayors and 155 or so managed by county managers. So it's not a new form. It's just something that Hawaii is not very much aware of. And, you know, I grew up here, and I wasn't aware that there was anything other than a mayor anywhere else.
But now, knowing that and having been talking about this for quite a while, there's the great possibility, perhaps, that voters will answer that question of which governance structure they want come November. But what has to happen between now and then to assure that that question would be asked?
Well, the committee that was formed, a special committee on county governance, has submitted their committee report and suggested charter changes to the council. And so the matter has been referred to our PIA committee, and which is Policy and Intergovernmental Affairs. And so that committee will be the one to hear the report and hear testimony before the council. And then we need to take action on that by the first week of August.
So the timeline
voted out by the council by then.
So that seems to be a reasonably short timeline, considering it's already the first week of June. As you look at the process that this proposal is in now, and also the way it was sort of set up on Friday when the council began to consider it, it almost looked like it was going to have a first reading. What happened?
We can have a first reading because it came from what was formed as a standing committee of the council. But it would be unusual for us to take up an issue of this significance just at the council level. So we felt it was appropriate to send it to a committee for a further review.
But wasn't there some
action?
I'm sorry, wasn't there some discussion that was being fast-tracked in that way and that was inappropriate?
Which was being fast-tracked?
That somehow, I mean, the way it looked going into the council meeting, I mean, just to look at how it was scheduled, it looked like it was almost coming up for a first reading and that there was some real opposition to the inappropriateness of that.
Well, no, I think it's appropriate for us to send it to a committee for a review. So that's what we've done.
At this point, when you have roughly 2 months and with the first long day of hearings is scheduled for the end of June, will there be any movement to move that a little closer to now?
It's unlikely because we have several members that are traveling in the meantime. And for this action, we, of course, want as many members as we can get to be present at the hearings.
Not that you could always be a prognosticator, but given the fact that you have only roughly 8-9 weeks before this would have to be down and done to get it onto the ballot, a sense from the council that this is moving forward or that there's too much opposition to it now?
Well, I don't, you know, with the Sunshine Law, I can't ask people where they stand as far as support or opposition. My sense is that the requirement to have 6 votes for any charter amendment proposal, my feeling is that the 6 votes are going to be tough to get.
So at this,
and so if the community is really interested in having this happen, they need to turn out and make sure that the council hears that they would like to have the opportunity to decide on this issue themselves.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thanks very much for the time this morning.
Thank you, Beth Ann. Have a great day.
You too.
Aloha.
Mike White is chair of the Maui County Council and represents Makawao, Haiku, and Paia. The choice to have that question put on the ballot will have to be decided by the council by August.
Next time on Living on Earth, the amazing journey of a mountain lion in search of love.
He had left probably when he was a teenager, about a year and a half old, and set out on this incredible cross-country journey that may have taken him across at least six states and most of Ontario.
The big cat who went walkabout. I'm Steve Kerwood, and that's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, following Fresh Air.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and coming up, a studio visit from Streetlight Cadence. But first, your quiz.
O Maui, o Kaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a prominent resident of the Northwest Hawaiian Islands whose numbers far exceed the human population of the island chain. An estimated 2.5 million of these seabirds live and breed here, making them the second most common seabirds in the Hawaiian Islands. Like all seabirds, they range far and wide. When they're away from their breeding areas, they're found from Japan to the Bering Sea and south to 15 degrees north latitude. They're among the smaller birds in their family, averaging 32 inches in length with a wingspan of 6.5 feet. Their adult weight is 5 to 9 pounds. They have a blackish-gray upper wing and back with a white head, lower rump, and underparts. Identifying marks include a black smudge around the eye and a bill that's pink with a dark lip. Their Latin name is Phoebastria immutabilis, and this morning we're looking for their English name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right will take home the HPR t-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Street performers learn a lot in a short time about how to connect with an audience. It's a few feet away, often vocal in its appreciation or lack of it, and quick to depart when attention lags. Waikiki became a launching pad for Streetlight Cadence, whose distinctive brand of alternative pop music has found ever-growing success. The band is back in the islands for a tour, and accordionist Jesse Shiroma is on hand to tell us more. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Pretty good. That's kind of where you got your musical education, isn't it? On the street.
You are absolutely right. At least I would say the performance aspect of playing in front of other people.
What did you learn and how did you learn it?
Well, we initially learned it through the college desperation of studying full-time and not having enough time to hold down a job. So as we all slowly started starving while holding up our grades, we realized we were all musicians, we were friends, and, we could go down to Waikiki and potentially play for an hour or two and make enough to buy a sandwich and, you know, physically last through another day.
Yeah.
And through doing so, you very quickly learn through the very fickle and unforgiving mentality of tourists that which songs work, what sounds may work, and what will chase them off faster than a Category 1 hurricane.
What were those early gigs like? Did you play songs that had people just turn and walk away at some point?
Oh, even worse. We would play songs where people wouldn't even stop. You would play for an hour, 45 minutes or so. And
just keep on walking?
They'll give you a smile, they'll give you a nod, and they're off to dinner.
Yeah.
Yep, so the goal was to be...
At least slow them down,
to
right?
sound better than their hunger. So if we sound better than them going to dinner or wanting to go to dinner, then we did something right.
Well, that's a very sort of visceral way to connect with people, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How long had you been at it before you started thinking maybe there's, you know, a career, dare I say it, in this?
We had been doing this as just a bunch of college hooligans for, I'd say, about 2.5 to 3 years or so. Mm-hmm. Just getting through our, you know, 4-year college programs. And I actually took a year off to go study in Germany for a year. And it was, of course, while I was gone that the band decided, you know, we could turn this into something professional.
Uh-huh.
So they started shooting for bigger gigs, and the Hard Rock Cafe was very accommodating with us and invited us in. So, of course, I was following this all on Facebook thinking, man, these guys were just waiting for me to leave. It was a rather funny situation. But, yeah, so it was about 2.5-3 years before we realized that, you know, we could get crowds stopped on the sidewalk after we found out what they enjoyed listening to, how to connect, how to look at them, smile at them, and most importantly, relate to them.
That's a big, the extra musical stuff is really important, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's showmanship. It's entertaining. There's wonderful videos out there on YouTube of just world-class, you know, symphony musicians playing some of the most complicated pieces in subways, metro areas, highly populated areas.
Yeah.
And no one bats an eye because, albeit these pieces are incredible, you know, they bring tears to my eyes. They're not necessarily entertaining in a relatable level. Some people just want to see movement or a smile. They want something to bring a little bit of joy into their day or excitement. And so especially that applies to street performing, to where they want to see something a little out of their normal boundaries.
There's a, you know, there's a show business adage about tell them and then tell them again. Don't assume that what you've done has communicated unless you say this is what it is and this is what its intention is, right?
There you go.
Not necessarily saying it in those words, but saying it with eye contact or
yep.
something like that.
Yep. Eye contact was a very hard thing for me personally to learn. John would have to always be like, Jesse, look at the audience. Yeah. I would always try to peer off to the side and just try to like lose myself in the music, as they say. But as an entertainer, you have to find that balance.
Yeah.
You know, you have to engage your music personally, but you have a duty to also engage your audience. If you just ignore them and focus solely on your music, you'll sound fantastic, but you kind of close them out.
I've learned from taking pictures of performing musicians that a lot of musicians look sort of insular and withdrawn and mopey
mm-hmm.
on stage, even if they're not, mm-hmm. but they're looking down, they're into what they're doing.
It's, absolutely.
It's understandable, but it doesn't do much when you're up on stage, right?
That's true. So it depends, yeah, who your audience is. Are they coming for the music, or are they coming for an experience, as they say? Or, you know, do they want to see the flashing lights and so forth?
And really very few people are there for just the pure musical experience, right?
That's why we have the albums, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, what's the life like for you now? You moved to L.A. as a band.
That's correct.
You got a couple places to live.
That's correct.
Well, and what's, you know, how, what do your days consist of?
Well, so as of now, we've been in L.A. for roughly 7.5-8 months. When we first began, we were slugging it out, starting from the ground up again in Los Angeles, playing on the 3rd Street Promenade in Santa Monica, about 6 days out of the week, 4 hours a day, just belting out at the top of our lungs, trying to get people to stop. But thankfully, as time went on, you know, people would stop and say, hey, kind of the formula reapplied in L.A., where they say, you want to play at my private event or, you know, my wedding. I have a corporate party going on. And we really started to grow through there. We're very fortunate and humbled to say, as of now, we're still able to support ourselves as full-time entertainers. None of us have had to start working at McDonald's just yet. I've been looking at that application, though. No. We're very fortunate to stay together as a team and support each other through that. And, yeah, so we're growing slowly but steadily, I'm happy to say.
You have to sort of deal with an entirely new music industry, at least new to what it was 20, 30, 40 years ago. Right?
Absolutely. It is absolute chaos. It's a maelstrom of wheeling and dealing. But it's once you sort through the chaff, you find a very well-connected, very passionate, and most importantly, an honest and humble core of industry professionals, whether they're music supervisors or producers or songwriters, other artists. And as you start to meet them and you work into that, you know, that circle of artists and people that you realize that it's, you know, it's doable. You can survive as an artist in Los Angeles or in the music industry.
Well, that's, I think a lot of people will benefit from hearing that, Jesse. Thanks for coming in.
Sure thing. You got to hang in there, you know, and be true to your path and, you know, try to focus on doing good and you'll attract those same kinds of people.
Well, that's a good message. Thanks a lot.
Certainly.
Jesse Shiroma plays accordion and percussion with Streetlight Cadence, which will kick off an inter-island tour with a performance this Saturday evening in our Atherton Performing Arts Studio. And you can learn more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
It's the final stretch of the presidential primaries. Hillary Clinton hopes to clinch the Democratic nomination.
I will work my heart out to give you the future that we deserve.
Six states decide, from New Jersey to California, where Bernie Sanders wants to win big.
I think we're going to win here in California.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Join us tomorrow when NPR teams up with WNYC and KQED for live coverage of the big night.
Tomorrow at 4 p.m. on HPR 1.
HPR selects and purchases programs from National Public Radio, American Public Media, and many other content providers. Our station members follow the money, and they realize that that trail starts and ends with them. We thank these enlightened individuals, Gretchen West of Honolulu, Leilani Olson of Kamuela, and Marga Stubblefield of Kailua. We'd like to add your name to our membership rolls. To do that, all you have to do is give us a call during business hours at 955-8821, or you can go online to hawaiipublicradio.org. And thanks.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting contemporary jazz ensemble Acoustic Alchemy in two shows nightly, June 14th through 19th. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
For years, activists on the Big Island have sought a no-take zone for fish captured and sold for aquariums. With the approval of the Board of Land and Natural Resources, there's now a 10-year fishing moratorium on a section of coastline on the west side of the island. Civil Beat Managing Editor Bob Ortega has today's reality check. Good morning, and thanks for pinch-hitting for Chad.
Good morning. I'm happy to be with you.
So let's talk about where exactly on the west side are we talking about?
Well, this is known as the Kaululehu area, and it's a 3.6-mile stretch of coastline that goes from Kalaimano to Kikaua Point. And the protection area extends from shore out to 120 feet of depth.
And what happens, you know, beyond that?
Well, then beyond that, those protections don't apply. So there's a 10-year moratorium on those specific waters in order to protect species that live very close to shore, many of which have been targeted for the aquarium fishing industry.
So these are what, like yellow tangs?
Yeah. There's a whole variety of fish. And a lot of this comes about because there have been a variety of studies that have shown a lot of depletion of nearshore species. And so, for example, there's a 2008 study that shows that 75% of nearshore species in Hawaii are in critical or depleted condition. And really, you can go out anywhere where a lot of these, if you go to any area where these fish are not currently protected, you'll see people taking them both from shore and from boats offshore. And so this is a very active industry here, but it's also one that's come under increasing pressure in recent years, which is why, although there was very strong support for this moratorium, there were more than 1,000 signatures in support, there were also a lot of people testifying against it, primarily fishermen, who say that people are targeting them as opposed to looking at other causes like pollution.
And they've been saying that for quite a while. I can imagine that the Hunting, Farming, and Fishing Association was staunchly opposed to this, too.
Yes, exactly. They're arguing basically that the resorts are supporting this and that they're benefiting at the fishermen's expense, so they were calling for more study, for example. And it's a very big issue. I mean, you've seen big fights in the last 2 years over expansion of protection for monk seals. You've seen a big fight federally over expanding the Papahanaumokuakea Reserve in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. So this is part of a much bigger fight.
And one that we're going to see ongoing. But this chapter of it seems to be reasonably close with a 10-year moratorium.
Yeah, yeah. And the supporters are arguing that 10 years will give a good chance for these fish species to rebound. And then we can take another look and see where we are.
All right. We're going to say goodbye for the moment, but talk to you again tomorrow.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Bob. Bob Ortega is the managing editor of Civil Beat, and he's sitting in for a few days while Chad Blair is on the East Coast.
Good morning, I'm Chris Vandercook, and at 8:30 on the nose, you're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. You can talk back to us about what you hear on the show on our talkback line, 808-792-8217, or you can find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or at BKOZHPR. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Coming up later, sharing the most important meal of the day with Antonio Vivaldi.
In the Atherton studio on June 18th, Ian O'Sullivan brings classical guitar stylings to his original compositions inspired by Oahu's majestic North Shore. Journey with him to the place he calls home by making your reservations today at hprtickets.org or by calling 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, there's a lot of people who think that some miracle medicines are already in existence out there somewhere, yeah?
Well, you know, when you look at it, a lot of our current medications truthfully have their roots, kind of pun unintended, from nature, from plants, from trees, from things like that. In fact, there's theories that there are a lot of different types of substances we have yet to discover in places like the Amazon that actually have significant medical potential.
And the whole idea of plant medicine has been around, of course, forever, but there's a whole new emphasis on it, isn't there, Kathy?
Well, I think there is because, you know, every time we turn around, there's a new side effect to a medication that we have developed and have used for a long time, and now we're seeing that people get these untoward side effects, and we've heard a lot recently about things like osteoporosis related to stomach medication, even some cases where they link that to memory loss as you get older. So we're going to take a look with a naturopath about some of the sort of all-natural ways that they treat medical illnesses, compare it to the ways that I treat it, and try and find some common ground. I think it'll be a really interesting discussion.
You know, the side effects have a way of not making themselves known until after a medication has been in use for a while, yeah?
Well, and it's because when we do what we call clinical trials, we have optimum circumstances. Mm-hmm. They select the people in the trials very carefully. They take away any other sort of variables like not taking the medicine regularly or don't let people in the trial with certain other types of medicines. And then when we get into the real-world application of things, it's a whole different ballgame.
Sure.
So very often we don't see that there's potential for side effects or problems until we've been using it for a while.
Well, all the more reason to look at naturopathic medicine. Thanks a lot, Kathy.
Thank you.
That's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak, tonight at 5.
Longtime Maui residents say that you can't help but see and feel the changes in the island. In the last 50 years, Maui's population has quadrupled, and the forecast in the next 50 shows tens of thousands more will call Maui home. But for now, who exactly is on Maui? Where are the transplanted residents coming from? To answer that question and a few more of who's on Maui, we called John Harrison, the Program Director for Research and Analysis at the Maui Economic Development Board. He's also been a Maui resident for almost 20 years, and he's on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethan. Good to be with you.
And thanks for making the time. You've been on Maui now for a couple of decades. There have been lots of people who were born and raised there and have seen many changes since the 1960s. But lately, we've been hearing from residents that there really seems to be a very different vibe about Maui, and that there seems to be a lot more people moving in from elsewhere. Does that have any basis in truth?
Yes, it does. It also reflects the fact that Maui has been a community in transition in terms of demographics over the last 50 years. It's been a pretty steady and consistent process. Back in the 60s, which is when jet travel began and the building of the major visitor industry resorts took place. Until then, agriculture was the main driving force of the economy. And so with the change over to a more diversified economy, but particularly with emphasis in the visitor industry, there's been a influx of people and a number of different demographic trends have been taking place. Probably one of the biggest ones is where people are from exactly. In 1990, as recently as that, about 65% of the Maui population was born either in Maui County or in the state. And now that proportion is down to about 50%. So of the other 50%, it's divided pretty evenly between those who have migrated to Maui and are now here permanently, either from the other 49 states or from international destinations. So probably about half and half. And I think people are a little surprised when they learn that as many as 25% of the population of Maui today is foreign-born.
As far as the projections for the coming years, where Maui's population will escalate, amazingly to what, another 80,000 people coming in the next 50 years or so, according to projections, is that also going to be including people coming from elsewhere?
It's likely to, and bear in mind those are projections, and they're based on extrapolating current trends or trends that have been established since about 1970. If you look at the demographic trend, it's in a straight upward line, with the exception of 2008 to 2010 when there was a hiccup due to the recession. But the projections show a continuation of that trend. And again, bear in mind that it doesn't take into account any black swan event or something unpredictable or even further recessions that we might see between now and the distant future.
But in looking at that future, even if there were to be some of those hiccups, the idea that more people are coming goes back to, well, where are they going to live and is there infrastructure in place and how are they going to get to where they need to go? All those questions that we talk about when we talk about a developing area. How is Maui answering those questions?
Well, the planning is underway. The Department of Planning is mindful of those projections, and the general plan for the county addresses some of those issues. But it is it's a very significant population increase. We're already seeing a shortage in terms of housing stock, and that's demonstrated by the continuing upward rise in single-family home prices, which the median price is now over $600,000. for condos, it's over 400,000. But we've also seen something of a crisis in the rental market, where there's a real shortage in rental properties, and that's reflected in the significant increase in rents that people are experiencing or have experienced over the last few years. But it's definitely a big issue. Likewise, in terms of infrastructure, we've seen a lot of many infrastructure improvements on Maui, especially over recent years, improvements in roads and in other kinds of infrastructure too. But it's certainly going to be a major challenge over the next 30, 40 years.
John Harrison, as we're also looking at where, you know, not only just where people are coming from, but what kind of resources are they bringing, and who are they? Are we talking about people who have great disposable income and they're coming to retire on Maui? Are we talking about people who are entrepreneurs? Who exactly are we talking about?
We're talking about both those groups. Two of the fastest growing subgroups that have migrated into Maui over the last 15 years, say, are those with Latino or Hispanic ethnic origins, and also those of retirement age, so in general do have a high disposable income. We are also seeing a lot of self-employed people that are coming in. It's a little bit harder to pin down exact numbers because often self-employed don't show up in employment statistics. But there's been a general trend over the last 15 years in terms of the influx continuing to be, in terms of ethnic background, largely Caucasian groups. So the share of the population of Caucasian origin, it's about now 36%, which is the single largest group in Maui County, and it's the only island in the state where that is true. Well, so those are the major groups that we're seeing come in. Back in the 90s, say, one of the largest single groups was Filipinos, who make up a significant proportion of those that are foreign-born residents.
Well, for the moment, we're going to have to just furlough this conversation for another day. But thanks very much. We've just begun to scratch the surface of who's on Maui, but that's a good thumbnail sketch. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bethann, and aloha.
And we'll talk again. John Harrison is Program Director for Research and Analysis at the Maui Economic Development Board. He's currently working on the Comprehensive Economic Development Strategy for Maui County, the State of Hawaii, and the U.S. Department of Commerce.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we told you about a seabird with an 80-inch wingspan that flies all over the Pacific and comes home to breed in the Northwest Hawaiian Islands. It's smaller than others in its family and is sometimes mistaken for a gull. It does its breeding in huge colonies on small islands and atolls, mating for life after choosing a mate with elaborate courtship rituals. Researchers have recorded these birds in courtship dances with up to 25 distinct movements. They're silent most of the time, but have been known to make sounds described as long mooing sounds, descending whinnies, or rattles. There's a colony on Oahu whose male-to-female ratio is 2-3, and nearly a third of whose nesting pairs are all female, raising chicks fathered by males who have strayed from their partners. They have an unusually long lifespan, with some birds recorded living 50, even 60 years. This morning, we asked you for the common name of this remarkable seabird. It's the Laysan albatross.
And Andrew Johnston from Kalaheo knew that, called in, and gets the T-shirt. It's now 8:45. That's today's quiz. If you have a question for us, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Gina Searles from Hawaii State Ballet. You're tuned to HBR2 Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @HIConversation.
It's Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our very small planet, plus what we can look for in our dark island skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips for this week's Stargazer Report. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's going on?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers look out for the planets of Mars and Saturn as they form a spectacular celestial triangle with the bright star Antares, located in the constellation of Scorpius. This time of year not only offers up a brilliant planetary spectacle, but it also gives us a prime view of the center of the Milky Way galaxy, which will look like a bright cloud passing through the southern sky. Catch it now before the moon becomes too bright towards the end of the week.
And today we have an interesting discovery that provides some illumination about the origins of an ancient artifact and how they connect to outer space. Do I have it right?
Absolutely, Dave. It has recently been discovered that an iron dagger buried alongside the famous Egyptian boy king Tutankhamun has turned out to be forged from metal that came from a meteorite that fell to Earth thousands of years ago. This space dagger was originally thought to be made of iron dug up from the Earth, but a new study has shown that that is far from the case.
So how did they figure this out, Christopher?
They used a technique called X-ray spectrometry to analyze the chemical makeup of the blade, which turned out to be made of iron containing nickel and cobalt.
And that doesn't seem too surprising because there's iron all over the Earth.
You're absolutely right. At first glance, this wasn't surprising at all, because iron is one of the most abundant metals found in the Earth's crust. What stood out for the scientists was that this iron contained nickel. Iron here found on the Earth contains almost no nickel at all, but we do know that iron found in meteorites does. This has led us to believe that this blade was in fact forged from a space rock.
Is there any kind of perception that the ancient Egyptians knew that this metal had come from a meteor or somehow from outer space?
Well, it's really hard to say. This meteorite could have lay buried in the Earth for hundreds, maybe even thousands of years before the Egyptians discovered it. So they may not have had any idea at all.
That is incredible. Christopher Phillips, and another exciting report. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week for Stargazer.
Support for Stargazer comes from HTA, a public charter school serving students grades K through 12 on each island, providing each student with the opportunity for a personalized learning plan combining face-to-face and virtual instruction. Learn more at myhta.org.
How do you reconstruct the personality of a great artist and bring him to life on stage? That's the challenge Jenny Morgan took on with her play Breakfast with Vivaldi, which takes us into the world of the prolific composer, virtuoso violinist, and sometime priest Antonio Lucio Vivaldi, 18th century Baroque maestro. Jenny is a performing musician herself, a harpist, and she's on the line with us now. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning.
You've probably had a lifelong relationship with Vivaldi's music, but getting into his personality was something else again, wasn't it?
Yes, that's true. There isn't much historical record to go by because Vivaldi has been recreated largely in our century by trying to dig up documents that relate to him.
Because for a long time, his music wasn't as popular as it is now, right?
That's correct. In the 1950s, there were only two recordings of the Four Seasons. It wasn't well known. And today there's over 5,000.
Well, that's a sign of growth, isn't it?
And popularity of his music.
So how do you, based on the evidence available, go about sort of figuring out what he was like?
I rely on historical documents, and I do a lot of research to find exact things that happened. So I'm not making up things, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a matter of piecing it together and sort of parsing it, if you will, into an exciting show, because this is the other object of my performance, is that I like to present classical music in a context that's entertaining.
Sure.
At least interesting to the audience.
Well, he was a renowned performer himself, yeah?
Yes. Yes, he was. During the latter part of the early part of the 1700s, yes. And I think his story in general has a lot of interest for today because, you know, in a sense, we're still fighting some of the same battles that he ended up fighting and what was eventually his demise and why we don't have any access to his records.
What battles were those?
As you may know, he was a priest originally, and
yeah.
His orchestra, he was assigned to teach in a girls' orphanage there in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
And his orchestra was made up of young, unmarried girls, virgin girls, and they became very famous, largely because of his musical skill and his performance. But this was during a time when girls were not allowed to perform in public, especially unmarried women.
Yeah.
So they had to go out and perform. They did perform, but they had to perform behind a screen and not be seen. Well, this is part of the intrigue of the story, because they took on mythological proportions of how beautiful they might be behind the screen.
Yeah.
But at any rate, the Inquisition eventually, at the end of his career, came to Venice, and the Inquisitor literally said, well, how is it you work with these virgin girls and you haven't had relations with them? And he said, well, I didn't. And they said, well, we don't believe you in this respect. So they banned him from Venice. They destroyed his music. And he ended up in obscurity in Vienna, where he died 4 years later. So it's largely because of the Inquisition that we don't have access to his music.
That's just one of the many frightening aspects of that particular movement, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the only way that we know about Vivaldi today really is because Bach, who also was discovered 100 years after he lived, literally,
yeah.
On one of his manuscripts had written, after Vivaldi. And people, during that period of time, this was in the 1850s, got excited. They said, wow, is the great composer Bach liked Vivaldi? Who was this guy?
Yeah.
And they tried to go back in history and find out. And we are still uncovering him through ancient records and things that people thought had been destroyed but exist somewhere else, and, you know, manuscripts and libraries uncovered. So it's a very intriguing story.
Well, Jenny, if you had to sort of, if you only had his music to try to piece together an idea of his personality, I would focus on a kind of exuberance that's there. He's a
yes.
He's a great creator of melody. But what other things do you find in the music?
What Bach really liked was his harmonic progressions.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to his music, you can hear them. They're wonderful harmonic progressions in which essentially they're working through the circle of fifths. And Bach really liked that. He thought that was wonderful. Yes, exuberance. There's a kind of naivety too about it that's very sweet.
Mm-hmm.
At least to me, that's my impression about Vivaldi.
Sort of an innocent quality.
Yes, yes. Most of the pieces that he wrote were for the girls in the orphanage. So he was writing for children,
yeah,
or young people to learn music. So there is that kind of innocence about it, you know. He did write a series of poetry that goes along with the Four Seasons, and they're, or at least we think he wrote those poems, and they're beautiful poems. They really enhance the music if a student is listening to it or trying to play it. We built that into the play also.
Well, it's certainly an intriguing idea for a project, Jenny. I wish you all kinds of luck with it. Thanks for talking with us this morning.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You bet. Ginny Morgan is the author of Vivaldi for Breakfast, an original play that will be performed at the Iao Theater on Monday, June 13th. It's a production of Early Music Maui and Maui on Stage, and admission is free. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Wall Street is a many-faceted beast.
There's a lot going on, and I'm hoping to at least illuminate some of the issues and some of the complexity involved in Wall Street.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a hedge fund manager who left finance for painting. We'll have that, the numbers from Wall Street, and the rest of the day's business news as well, next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following The Body Show.
Beth Ann, I can't think of a time in Hawaii when a county government has looked at restructuring itself, which is kind of what's happening on Maui, it seems.
That and so many changes happening on Maui. It just seems that it's caught in its own maelstrom, driven by the fact that population, as we talked about a little earlier today, quadrupled since the 1960s, that the forecast for many tens of thousands of people to arrive on Maui largely from elsewhere, as we see happening already, given the population distribution that we talked about earlier with John Harrison. It's a very different island for a lot of reasons.
It's a huge demographic shift from what it was a generation ago.
And some would say even a couple of generations now, that those changes on Maui are presenting so many issues that that island is going to have to grapple with. And if you go over there and you visit, you already know that, that things are changing. Even if you go to the airport and you see the build-out around the airport and where you're going to be getting your car soon, all of that. We're going to talk about it all this week. And thanks very much for those of you who have already written in to say that this series is really resonating. We'll have more as the week continues. Starting tomorrow, when we're going to find out what's up with the jobs market on Maui with Department of Labor and Industrial Relations Director Linda Chu Takayama.
And Kauai Voices prepares its upcoming show, Ain't That Great Music.
In the meantime, be in touch with us on our talkback line. It's always available at 808-792-8217 or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. That's me.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, you can find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning right back here for more of the Conversation. See you then.